I'd like to do is go till 12:30, and there will be a break between the morning session, 10 to 12:30. Then we're going to have an hour and a half lunch break. And I think everybody has their own lunches or goes out like that. And then the next session will be 2 to 4 this afternoon, if that's good for people. Wonderful. Thank you. So just have your back, as if your back is straight, the spine as extended as possible. Most of you are familiar with meditation posture. Just find a way to be comfortable in this position, and if you're in a chair, no problem. Just have your feet straight down. So most of you are familiar, but normally you place your palms face up, right palm on the left. Okay? It's right against the level of your body. So the arms end up being a little bit out. We were re-instructed and introduced to this posture at last year's Light of the Path retreat with Lama Zopa Rinpoche. It was as if I'd never heard. It was like a whole new posture for me. Rinpoche explained all the details. The thumbs are touching, but they're in a triangle that is a reminder of completion stage tantric practices. So everything has a significance in Tibetan Buddhism. So there you go, yep. So if you find what happens, if the hands are down, you tend to slouch a bit. Yeah. So again, you know, it's erect, so it keeps you alert because you have to hold your hands up. So again, you experiment. I know there's a lot of different meditation postures. Okay. The eyes are lightly closed. Focus towards the tip of the nose or the floor in front of you. Just allow your body to find its way into this position. And take a minute to scan from your head all the way down and out through your feet, noticing any places you're holding tension in your body, and allowing your normal, natural breath to open up some space, allowing the tension to release. And bring your awareness to a normal, natural breath. And just follow the air as it goes in your nostrils, leaving the nostrils on an exhalation. Keep the concentration there. If it wanders, you just bring your mind back. just allowing the mind to settle, take a moment to consider your intention right now, your reason for being here. So you may get some information today, may do some practice today that may give you some insight into the nature of your mind and how that can open your heart. So it can be, maybe it's useful for you. And if you can imagine that you could expand beyond your own boundaries, that you could reach out and help others. And in the Mahayana tradition, to become a Buddha, then you're unlimited in helping others. So if you'd like to include that in your intention, take a moment, trying to place the mind in as positive a space as possible. Set a good intention for this time together and all the activities of the rest of your day. And please relax and slowly open your eyes. Who wasn't here last night? Where were you? Okay. Anyway, we're going to continue on. I'm doing this is about generating compassion. How do we fully open the heart, awaken the heart? And I'm just going to continue on, and I'm bringing in various things from His Holiness the Karmapa, Thupten Jinpa, who is His Holiness's translator when he is in the West, who has a beautiful book called A Fearless Heart that comes from his compassion training that he does at Stanford. And he's also a professor at McGill University in Montreal. Some things from, we're going to talk later, Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Brian Stevenson, things about what prevents us from fully waking up, from opening our heart. Things like this. And then we're going to do some Chenrezig practice with this booklet. So thank you to Donna and Kadampa Center for making that available and hosting me and everything like that and all the efforts. Okay? So we started in with what compassion is and why it's so important. And particularly today, I would say, today's world, a lot of people were very challenged last year based on the divisiveness of the presidential election that we had. So what happens is we tend to gravitate in these spaces to alienation. And the greatest thing that I'm going to keep coming back to is about connection. About connection. Can you find a way to, when fear arises, when anger arises, or depression, you're folding in on yourself and closing up or numbing yourself, is first we have to analyze, which is something we do in Tibetan Buddhism. Please analyze, okay? But the main thing is, can you find a way to stay connected? Can you find a way to, as painful as it is, to reach out? And then it's also about exploring the pain. Exploring the pain. And it's interesting how so many of these different leaders and books I've read, and it's all about the only way to finish the pain is to go through it. So you have to face it. And if you don't face it now, I'm sorry to tell you, you'll be facing it when you die. It's going to be there. So why not look at it now when I'm in more control of my mind? We'd like to think, right? More control of our mind. And who was here yesterday? Okay. So we had a few exercises last night. I asked people to, the beginning of bodhicitta, development of bodhicitta, we're going to talk more about. This is the traditional rollout from Tibetan Buddhism. There's two methods to develop bodhicitta. The more open public one is six-point cause and effect method that came from Master Sirlingpa in Indonesia. The secret method from Master Shantideva is called equalizing and exchanging self with others. So I ask people to consider, of the six-point cause and effect, the first point is that all beings have been your mother. All beings have been your mother. How is it possible? And without elaborating over what I explained last night, Buddhism talks about beginningless mind. The mind has no beginning, because there are moments of consciousness or moments of mind, each one preceded by a moment of mind that caused it. Each moment preceded by a moment of mind that caused it. So you can never trace back to the first moment, because Tibetan Buddhism says that moment has a moment before that preceded it that caused it. There's always a preceding cause, and as a result of that, there's no beginning to the mind. There will always be another moment that caused it, which gives you the option, there is a potential, that we have had countless lives. And in the countless lives, we've had a mother in every life. So the potential exists that we've been each other's mother at some point or another. We've had that connection. So I ask people to go out, try to remember last night and this morning, that all beings have been your mother, to see beings like that. Anyone remember? How did it go? You didn't have any connection, okay. All the people here? Right? It's interesting. Any comments? Yes. Here comes the microphone.
That's for people who are streaming.
Thank you.
So my boyfriend and I were driving home and thinking about this, and we have a lot of issues with our mothers. So we were trying to think of basically connecting with, because you said you can look at other people's, the way they've mothered and other people have loved. And so we, kind of went to like our kids, and then even how we are with our pets, and just basically just kind of a love that's different than a romantic love or a friendship love, that kind of love where you would just do anything for another person that you don't think about it and you don't even understand that kind of love. And so that's the way that we were able to connect with that. Mm. And just think this other person wouldn't even, other people that were our mothers in other lives, they didn't even think about it, and they sacrificed and loved us in a completely different way that we even go through our daily lives, and we forget that there's a love like that that exists most of the day.
Mm-hmm. And a little bit more of a connector to you with these other beings?
Yes, because somebody almost killed us last night. it was a speeding truck, and he didn't have his headlights on, and he just kind of came up over this hill, and I think, you know, we were just like, okay, well, we love that word that you kept using was confused. And
confusion, yeah,
confused. About what the speed limit is. And a lot
right.
of times when people have their headlights off, it means that maybe they're impaired, and so we're thinking he's just a very confused person, and we just, for some reason, it didn't bother us as much as it would have. We would have been very angry, and he's a so-and-so, and we just were in a place where we were able to just say, oh, well, you know.
Interesting. Yes, it does reflect stuff. See, I mean, to use it like that, thank you, is so helpful because it can enter in some kind of softer response to reality, to the external reality. And when I was saying confusion, we might call it also in Tibetan Buddhism ignorance. And ignorance can sound a little heavier, but we all suffer from it. Unless you've had a direct perception of emptiness, we all experience that. So, and what happens is the truck comes over the hillside with its lights off speeding, you know, fear arises in you, right? And then we lash out from there. We lash out from there. So anger immediately pops out after the fear because I don't want to admit that I'm afraid and I don't want to face my fears. So it's easier to get angry. It's easier to get angry. You know, instead of coming back with, wow, maybe this person's struggling just like I am, and suddenly there's, you know, the ability to help somebody else rather than your other, you're interfering with my bubble, my agenda, like that. And then anger as well, fear can be underneath. There's another thing that can be underneath anger. Anybody?
Hatred?
Hatred, well, it would be the same as anger. I would equate that with anger. Yep, definitely. Hatred. But you've got, you've got anger out there, armoring, and fear clear, like you get afraid and then, you know, and so often we want to lash out. Often sadness is another thing that's under there, right? You know, you're sad, and sometimes, I don't know if you've ever heard this, but before, because I find anger is sad's bodyguard. Do you ever notice that? You have to check your mind, please. Please check up on whatever I'm saying. Please check up. Don't just accept what I'm saying. Please investigate thoroughly. Check in your own mind or life. Is this really what it's like? So you get sad. Do you ever notice? And I notice this with people. And because we are a competitive society, we talked about this last night, so what happens is you hear that somebody else is going to Hawaii for vacation. And some people have a natural rejoicing effort. I learned that in Buddhism. It's the easiest way to create positive energy for yourself. Rejoice. Okay? If you're not a natural rejoicer, initially you force it. Seriously. This is practice. I wasn't a natural rejoicer when I was a kid. Right? So then I heard in Buddhism, so I would hear, you know, she got the new job that, you know, and I'd be like, great. I tried, you know, at least the face got into the, but I actually practiced it. And now I hear something good happens for someone. And already there's something dismantled in me where I'm not layering myself up comparing next to them. Already that's dismantled because that caused me suffering. Why do I need to do that? I just hear they're going to Hawaii. So now I genuinely have a fantastic, right? Great. It comes automatically. So sometimes we have to practice to get the automatic response. But what happens is something happens, you lose somebody, somebody dies, that's the worst kind of sadness we have, but other things happen. Financially you're struggling, the program at the center is not going how you wanted this to happen, this is your car is breaking down and you see your neighbor got a new car. Yeah, I mean there's many things, job issues with your families, with kids, interrelations. And then sadness pops up, which is a normal situation of human existence. And a lot of people don't want to look at sad because it's uncomfortable, right? So anger comes out. The bodyguard to armor. You don't need to look at sad. I'm here. And then somebody pokes you the wrong way on that day that you're sad and you get angry. So check it out. I find anger is sad's bodyguard. And often also covering fear. You don't want to admit that you're afraid. Why? Because that may make you vulnerable. Last night, the words people associated with vulnerability were weakness. What were some of the other words? They were all negative words, I thought.
Shame.
Shame. You know, that's intense. Like that. So we're reframing some of these words. I said last night from Brené Brown, I mentioned, she rewrites the story that vulnerability is about innovation, creativity, and change. She has several books out, sociologists. You can watch one of her TED Talks. Vulnerability is the birthplace, she says, of innovation, creativity, and change. Well, that is different. That's quite positive, right? You don't like the way something's going along, and so you're not doing it well. It makes you vulnerable. You have to shift. You have to be creative about how you're going to innovate to change things. That can be exciting. So all beings have been your mother. Any other last comments anybody wants to say about that? That was. We also mentioned having your heart open to pain, your pain and others' pain. Anybody reflect on that last night? Why you don't want to look at your pain or others' pain? What happens when it's in your face? Anybody's experiences? Makes you vulnerable. Makes you ready to innovate, create, and change something, right? Right? But maybe that's the old word of makes you vulnerable, the old vulnerable. What we used to think of vulnerable, right? And often it's uncomfortable for people to talk about. We don't want to get in there, okay? So we're going to talk more about that because that's your way through to compassion. The last thing I mentioned was finding meaning in life. Finding meaning in life. So some of you are new here today. So this is something we're going to explore that I'm going to ask you to look at today and if you come back tomorrow. Some of you are quite clear about your meaning in life. Some of you have never thought about it before. So what gives your life meaning, purpose? What lights you up? And I was saying, it's not superficial happiness. Like, this is fun. It's when are you deeply content? When are you deeply content? Meaning, when you go to sleep at night, you know this was a well-done day. I feel right in sync with what I'm supposed to be doing. And okay? Everybody understand? So anybody last night reflect on anything pop up about their meaning? And how many are streaming? Anybody streaming?
Four people,
okay.
Hello, four people. I was thinking about last night and this morning that when you're kind of laying in bed, it's so easy to think this is content. So I kind of let that superficial, that relaxation when I'm just, that softness in you, Saturday morning, do whatever you want to do. And that feels like this nice, happy, just content feeling. And then I kind of look behind that and wanting to be here today, but kind of wanting to sleep in, you know, just that sense of wanting to be home in jammies with my daughter. And every single time that I've sat right here, I'm, you know, looking at you, and I'm with in front of Geshe-la, in front of Lama Zopa Rinpoche, that is like, there is nothing else I'd rather do. That feeling of this is it, just sit and listen, soak it in, and do it. And so sometimes at home, you know you want to be here. There's not like you don't. But it's not until you actually are just sitting right here that you realize this is it. This is everything I want to do.
Yeah, and you feel
connected.
I mean, because I had a similar, in about 20-some years ago, I was running a center in California, Vajrapani Institute. And so we were kind of exploring that just as a staff, you know. And sometimes you're checking, especially in your 30s, I think more so your 20s, 30s, even in the 40s, you're checking every few years of your life, am I, you know, building my career? Is this, am I doing the things I'm supposed to be doing and things like that? You go through that for a phase. And then I started to live and work at Dharma centers, the residential centers. So, but somehow I was, you know, we're running a retreat. I'd been there a couple of years, and we were hosting a big month-long retreat. And we had about 80 people there, living there with us the whole time. And so I was kind of in this thing of what I really felt was the meaning of my life and purpose, and things that made me very happy was, like, you know, a beach holiday. That used to be my thing. You know, everybody has their own thing, but I was like, oh, that's when I'm really, that's the best thing in my life, is that. So then I kind of, over this kind of couple of years I first got to the center, I would kind of check, and I knew that the beach holidays I had, there weren't many of them, but after a while I got bored. You know, I read all my books, and it was like, I mean, it was great, but had it gone on too long, I don't think I would have enjoyed it anymore. It just wasn't feeding something in here. It was fun. It was relaxing, and it was great. It was all those things, all these things that I'd wanted it to be. But, and then we were at the center hosting this retreat, separate. And one night we went out to the stupa. We also had a stupa. It's fantastic. You have this shrine, the stupa. And we went out, and some of my closest friends at the center, it was a beautiful night. We finished the last session, and a number of us found ourselves walking around the stupa at dark with these beautiful lights on, magical flowers around, and I was kind of higher than I'd ever been. And everybody was happy, and everybody was saying, the retreat was going very well, the staff was happy, the retreaters were great, the lamas were happy, and it just, everything was in sync, and I just thought, this is it. This is that moment. And then what I wanted to do is, I want to do more of this. I thought, this is where I'm really being deeply nourished. This is my purpose. This is what I want to do. So I just started to direct my life in that way, to make sure I could do more of that. And I did. So that's why I was saying it's really essential that you find it now if you haven't already found it. Explore it now, because you direct the trajectory of your life. It's your choice. You can do it. You can do it. A lot of times you got waves coming over you of other stories. You can't do this. You can't do this. But we are free, as we mentioned last night. In our culture, looking around the room, we have a lot of freedom. And I know we all have problems. I don't know all of you. I don't know the level of the problems. However, we really have a great deal of freedom. It's sometimes just the inner story we tell ourselves that we're not good enough, that makes the limitations. Okay. So again, practice slowly, consistently, to start to reframe a new story. And then slowly try to make your way to what the meaning is. What the meaning is. It's a process, so it's not going to be delivered like by the time the class ends today. It's a process. Make sense? So please try it. It's really important because it makes you happier. Makes you happier when you know you're manifesting yourself in the best way that is possible for you. And you can only try your best as well. You can only try your best. You may hit a thing and say, oh, I really wanted to be that. I want to be a doctor. But I started too late. I want to do that. And so you know what? I'm going to go over here and I'm going to do this. I can still help people, but this is more realistic. You have to be realistic as well. I mean, for me, I always, as a kid, I wanted to go into outer space. So I could say, well, that would really, you know, well, that's not realistic for me to do. I'm not going to start directing my life in that way. Come on. You know. So, again, you have to be somewhat realistic. So thank you. Anyway, those are still some exercises you can continue to explore. Continue to explore. And just to a little bit bring us in, to connect us from yesterday, this is Thupten Jinpa, A Fearless Heart. His book is called A Fearless Heart. It's a beautiful book about compassion, very practical. But he says a fearless heart, if we're trying to totally open up our heart, a fearless heart embraces the fundamental truth of our human condition. So what I said yesterday, and I'm sorry to break this to you, the fundamental truth of our human condition is pain and suffering. So it sounds bleak, But it's not, because we will traverse through the pain and suffering. But you have to go there first. You have to face it. Okay? As human beings, we make mistakes. We are flawed. Again, I'm not laying a trip on you to say that you're bad. I'm just facing reality. I make mistakes. I'm a Buddhist nun, and I make mistakes. I completely accept that about myself now. I didn't before. I didn't many years ago. So was holding myself to a very rigid constraint, and then anybody that came around me was subjected to that. It's not very pleasant. Right? And then you try running a center. Even worse, right? So I got great insights from the staff that worked with me, particularly Vajrapani, wonderful people. And okay, so this is the fundamental truth of the human condition. I accept it, right? It doesn't mean I set myself up to make mistakes, but when I make one, fall flat on my face, I may lay there for a moment in the pain and the suffering of like, okay, well that sucked. Pick myself up, okay, with eyes open, awareness. What happened? My goodness. And it can be a small thing. You know, I live with my elderly dad. He's 90 next month. He's doing well, right? Thank God he's doing well, right? But times I lose my patience with him, right? Because short-term memory is not so great. So it's times I lose my patience, and then I'll notice I say a little snippy barb, and then later I go, whoa. That's the kind of mistakes I mean. But we make big mistakes, and we make small mistakes. So I might do that, and then later I'm doing my practice, and I'll say, you know, what was that about? You don't want to be like that. What's happening? So then I have to look at it. Sometimes now I catch it right away, and I'll say, look, sorry, I didn't mean that. You know, the more practice, then we're automatically there with, or I'm going to catch it in my mind before it exits my mouth. And I'll just watch frustration arise. I know you're really frustrated right now. I'll just speak to my delusion. I know you're really pissed off right now. Right? But just let it go. It's just another cloud in the sky. My mind's actually okay. Don't open your mouth right now. Not going to say anything nice. Like that. Talk to your delusions. It's okay. Okay, but sometimes this stuff happens. Something negative. Pick yourself up, but you must analyze. So having a meditation practice on the side, I find, is a hugely helpful component to opening the heart. For me, it's really necessary. So I can come back to my cushion where I do my internal practice and evaluate and investigate what happened, right? And then a little bit of a role play there with a new behavior, a positive behavior. What could you have said? What could I have said to my dad when he started doing that? You know, and then I practice it in my meditation. I practice it again and again, meaning I put him in front of me and I say the right thing. And I say the right thing. He continues to say the other thing that pushes the button, right? Eventually you dismantle the button. Gone. But I slowly practice, and one day it automatically happens. That's why we practice. That's why we call it practice. So the beginning is kind of waking up to this is our situation. Samsara, I mentioned yesterday. And this is Thupten Jinpa again. We can develop the courage to see and be more compassionately in the world, to live our lives with our hearts wide open to the pain and joy, he adds, of being human on this planet. It's not just pain, okay? It's actually a glorious part of life. It is absolutely glorious. You look outside today. Last night, the big moon. Beautiful. Beautiful. Today, unbelievable. Unbelievable. And we passed, thank you to Venerable Khandro who was driving me, and we passed all the trains of the circus. The circus is in town, right? The last circus, yeah. I mean, it's really the end of an era, isn't it? For those of you that, you know, I grew up when I was little, we went to the circus a couple times, and well, one time there was a small circus, I just remember, that came. I don't remember, my parents took us. I was very young. But I just remember it poured. One of the tents collapsed. Like, really, one of the tents collapsed because it was a smaller circus. And something, and I remember, like, some kind of elephant backing into my mother. And I mean, it was one of these like frightening, like sometimes when I think of circus, I have a little bit dark element in my mind of like the circus, you know, because it was one of these like disastrous kind of everybody kind of running away in the pouring rain. And but the circus, you know, there are many, many cars. I didn't realize how huge this train is that they came in on the train. Okay, so there's many glorious things about life. The more I explore my pain, understand my pain, and start to move through it, the more glorious my experience of life is, the happier I am. So we have to look at it, okay? And so as utterly social and moral creatures, this is Thupten Jinpa, we each yearn to be recognized and valued. We long to matter, especially in the lives of those whom we love. We like to believe that our existence serves a purpose. We're meaning-seeking creatures. So it's through connecting with other people that actually can lend purpose to your life. So check out if you're not clear about your meaning, what's your purpose in life, what's your deeper meaning. You might explore, is there some kind of service I can be to others? Because I found that lends tremendous meaning to many people's lives, particularly my own. That was the catch, actually. That was the catch for me. Everybody's different. I know we're all wired differently. But that was the biggest catch for me. All these self-serving things I did were great. But once I kind of flipped it out from myself to somebody else, it gave very deep meaning in here to me. I was deeply satisfied with something. So please check up. And there's many ways you can serve, many capacities. And the other thing is, look for helpers. Look for the helpers, okay? And be careful who you surround yourself with. In developing the open heart, be careful who you surround yourself with. Does anybody have a ruminating mind in here? Right? You turn through stuff. What do you turn through? What do you think about? What do you worry about? Yourself and many of the issues in your life, you ruminate, okay? Sometimes we ruminate and you get it, and what rumination does, it creates a trench in your mind of whatever you're ruminating about. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche's trench is highly blissful and peaceful and happy. That's what he ruminates about. For instance, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, some of you have met him? Okay. He leads this retreat, Light of the Path. Some people find he's a little too enigmatic for people, or he's very otherworldly, okay? They have trouble understanding him. That's what's kind of nice about Light of the Path, because you have a board behind him, somebody typing. So if you don't understand, you can read the board. You get much more out of it. Increases the whole experience for you. So his gossip, you know, we gossip and we waste a lot of our speech energy through blah, blah, blah. It's not just talking about someone behind their back. It could be going on and on and on about the latest sporting event you saw, and the person you're talking to is not really interested. Do you ever have this where somebody gives you the whole plot of the movie they just saw, and you're like, you know, I don't need all the details. Just right. So, remember, this is Lama Zopa Rinpoche's gossip. Rebu Rinpoche? Rebu Rinpoche is one of his gurus, one of my teachers as well. Amazing. Rebu Rinpoche, amazing Lama. Incredible. So what he does is he might have things looping in his mind that's all very positive. What is your rumination about? What trench are you making? Okay? So it becomes very easy for people in our culture to blame, criticize, and find everything wrong. We sometimes have world leaders that promote this, that show us this is okay. For me, what was challenging, after 9/11, I was stuck out of the country because, as I was told by one airline clerk, I'm sorry, madam, you can't fly today. The United States is closed. Literally, I was told that in Nepal, leading a pilgrimage group to get back to San Francisco. The United States was closed. It was the first time I ever heard that. And then finally, when we got to some TVs to watch the news, a couple days later, there was our president at the time, George Bush, Jr., and he was standing at the site, and then what I remember him saying indelibly was, so we're going to show them. Like, they showed us, and we're going to show them. So it was about vengeance. The teaching was vengeance for me. And the thing is, if you're a young child, and you see the President of the United States saying that, you think that's what you should emulate. That's what we should do, because the president's strong, he's powerful, I want to be like that. So we have to be careful who we surround ourselves with. And so I don't know, I don't care how you voted, it doesn't matter. There's no good or bad people inherently at all in anything. But what I found interesting is how things change. Because there's no inherently, a lot of people made George Bush a target when he was president. He was the great evil. Really? Really? Right? Some people loved him and voted for him. Thought great. No problem. Yeah, so you can't say he's inherently good or bad, this one person. What I found interesting, did anyone here watch the inauguration this year? Some people watch it. I watched a little bit of it. I didn't watch the whole thing. I didn't, you know, I don't spend too much time on the TV, but what I found interesting is when George Bush showed up and I saw him, my mind was quite happy to see him. And I don't know if I felt that about him when he was president. But suddenly I went, oh, and my dad was watching, and I said, oh, look, and I said, oh, and I said to my dad, and I had this, like, positive in my mind, right? And then I said, oh, look, he looks good. Oh, it's nice to see him. You know, that was new. So it was so interesting how things change. Things change in your mind. Nobody's inherently this or that. It's not. We don't need to hold our minds hostage by holding that person in your mind like that. You know, I know I had a feeling if I ever sat down, had tea with George Bush, I'm sure I would really like him. I think he's probably a nice person. That's what I've heard about him. Challenging to be president, right? Any of you here interested in that job? No. It's a very challenging job. How can we not have compassion? You know, in that sense, so I worked in electoral politics. I worked in Washington, D.C. for many years in electoral politics, where meaning people are running. You're trying to get people elected. It's a terrible, terrible process in this country. Really needs to be reformed. It's a horrible, grueling process I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. I don't really have any enemies, but I wouldn't wish it on anybody, you know? It's really a horrible... So after last year's process, right, I just thought of how, let's say the two candidates we had shredded by the process. I would have been shredded by the process, meaning I needed a month's holiday to recover. A month's holiday easily to recover. Just grueling process what you're going through. Everybody's in your face and everybody's attacking you. And everything you say is a mistake. It's just like that. It's just a horrible process. So imagine these people. Now I know they chose it. You wanted to do it, but still, I mean, my heart really goes out. I think, not a fun thing. And for one of the persons elected, there was no break. There's no break. It just escalates. It gets worse. Gets more pressure. And then you just roll right into the office. It's unbelievable, really. So look for helpers, okay? Are your helpers around you promoting divisiveness through their speech? Are they promoting negativity? Are they blamers? Always trying to find fault? Criticizing, okay? But there's always people who are positive, wanting to connect, finding an optimistic spin on things. Who do you surround yourself with? It doesn't mean you cut people out of your life. It's just I have reduced time I spend with some really negative people. Because I weighed, is that most beneficial? Doesn't mean they're not, especially if it's family members, not going to cut anybody out of my life. I'm quite loyal, actually, for friends, like long-term friends and things. But it's just a matter of how much time you decide. And I always find when somebody's very negative, sometimes I've found ways to interrupt what they're saying, change the subject. And if I'm very close with them, I've actually said, I'm not really comfortable right now with what you're talking about. Can we talk about something else? Or find something positive about the person that they're trashing. Again, so be skillful. Be skillful in trying to keep this open. I try to have my heart remaining open to this person's misery. Sometimes they're in a lot of pain, which is where it's coming from. So it's easy, again, to have anger cover over, protect, because I don't want to look at my pain. Why? It's uncomfortable. It's really uncomfortable. Okay. A lot of my spiritual practice is getting comfortable with the uncomfortable. Then you're more comfortable with it, really, and then you are. More peaceful. You see somebody's pain and suffering. Quickly, can I do something? I ask myself, can I do something about it? I will try to act with as much compassionate wisdom as I can. Sometimes I can't do anything. Let it go. Right? You can listen to people. So the other thing we get into is fixing. We want to fix it. Because fixing it means it'll go away. Okay? But again, if I want to go back to the fundamental truth of our human condition, a lot of it you can't fix. If you want to fix the fundamental truth of your human condition, get enlightened. Progress along the path to higher realization. That will shift that for you, definitely, absolutely. Okay? But sometimes in basic human condition, you know, somebody loses their lifelong partner. That's life. That's what happens. Now, you don't say, I'm not going to say, well, hey, I mean, you know, things are impermanent. Of course not. No, so you listen to somebody, you just be with them. Can you just be with their pain? It's uncomfortable. But that's our job. That's our job to show up as Buddhist practitioners. If you want to walk along this path, but if you want to be just a solid person and support for your friends, sometimes you just have to be there with somebody's pain and not fix it. I think I mentioned maybe we did a death and dying course here once some years ago. Can't remember. So I do a lot of hospice work, and I had a lot of hospice training in San Francisco when I lived there at the height of the AIDS epidemic. It was very intense work. In the late 80s, people were then living 2 years with AIDS. Initially, you lived 6 months and you died. After late 80s, they got some medicines developed and people were living 2 years, but they still died. Now we know it's very different. It's like a chronic illness, HIV. So people have their medicine, they're living very well, very healthy, like that. So in the late 80s, we were matched with clients. I was an emotional support counselor. And I had a guy I was with for 2 years. He became a very good friend, nice guy, and he was dying of AIDS. And it was horrible how he was dying. So in the end, a few days before he died, I went to the house. And I get to the house, I went once a week, and then later I went more. And as soon as I got to the house and his lover opened the door and saw me, his lover's like, okay, he's in the bedroom. And his lover ran out of the house, had his jacket, was waiting for me to come, needed to get out. So what happened is I walk into the house and Rick is screaming, like really screaming in pain, like really loudly screaming. I went in the bedroom. What do you do if somebody's screaming? I didn't know what to do. I was clammy. I was shaking. I got all flushed. To be with somebody screaming, I wanted to fix it. I wanted him to stop screaming, like right away. But so I went in. He's sitting on the edge of the bed. And the pain meds weren't working, and whatever was going on with his body, and he couldn't get, you know, and he. So I walked in the room and I saw him, and I said, "Is it okay if I'm here?" And he could only go like this while he was screaming, and then I said, "How about if I just sit down next to you on the bed?" And he, you know, I said, "You can say no. You're not going to offend me. Just." And I said, "I'm just going to sit here." And then I said, "Can I just put my hand on your back?" He's in like a hospital robe, and he's, you know, because usually AIDS patients at that stage, nobody wanted to touch them like that. And so I just said, and if it bothers you, you just shake your head, and I'll take, you know, I said, I'm just going to be here with you. It's okay. I'm just going to stay here. So I stayed there. He screamed for 45 minutes. It was the hardest thing I've ever done, I think, in some ways. I mean, it was just psychically, and I just stayed there, and I couldn't fix it. And slowly, the thing is, it changes. Things always change. So it changed, and somehow, whatever it was, and it subsided a little bit, and I was able to get him back into bed. And then I remember I was leaving, I got him back into bed, and I started to move away from the bed, think to get him some water or something, and he grabbed my wrist really strongly, and then he said, you know, thank you for not leaving. Like, thank you for being here. Because, you know, his lover just kept leaving the house. He couldn't deal with it because his lover had HIV. He wasn't ill, but he was facing his own demise and was totally freaked out, understandably. So can you just sometimes show up and just be there for somebody? You don't need to say anything. I didn't say anything for 45 minutes. I just sat there trying to connect. Wasn't anything special. I'm not any great, you know, special person. But it was the first time I decided, because I'd run from a lot of things, and I just said, I'm just going to try to hang out here, you know. I mean, I was, like, burning up with, like, I mean, I was just, it was the most uncomfortable situation I've ever been in that respect. Totally uncomfortable. My mind racing around the room. I'm like, when's it going to stop? Is it ever going to stop? Like, what's going on with his body? You know, can I do anything? And sometimes there's not. So somebody says they just lost their husband of 40 years, and you say, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. Can I do anything for you? Can I help you? Like that. And sometimes it's just a matter of just being there. I'm so sorry. I don't have to say anything else. My sister lost her husband of 25 years to suicide many years ago. It was awful. He was very ill for many years. And one of her friends, she said, that showed up, at the that came to see her, she said, and people would say all these things because they're uncomfortable, and then they say things that really don't help. So she said the most honest thing somebody did that she found very helpful was one of her friends came, and everybody was in shock because it was a suicide, and a lot of people didn't know how ill he was, and one of the friends came and said to her, I'm so sorry, and they were just looking at each other, and then the friend just said, I don't know what to say. And she said that was just the most honest thing because you don't know what to say. And so she just said that. Instead of busying it up with, he's in a better place now. Or, I mean, how do you know where he is? When people say that, you know. My brother used to say that when my mom died and these cousins came. She's in a better place now. My brother said, how do they know where she is? Right? So I think it's something about that honesty for ourselves. You reach in. And just be who you really are as opposed to who you think you are. That you find the comfort there. You know, because once I hung out with Rick for 45 minutes screaming, it's much easier for me to do it with somebody else. I don't like it. I don't have to like it. I'm uncomfortable, but I'm much easier for me to hang out now with somebody's pain. Once you do it, again, it's practice. I rehearse, so I'm getting myself familiar with that. So there is a lot of pain in life, but it helps me also appreciate the joy like that. So the other thing is compassion. Opening your heart, again, like I was just saying, takes practice. Mother Teresa, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, they got good at compassion because they worked at it. So the seed of compassion, please know, is present in all of us right now. We all have that seed. People have different levels of compassion that is exhibiting itself right now. So you'd like to have more, so you can grow that seed. And the conditions it takes is sunlight, moisture, fertilizer. That's the practice. That's the different layers of practice that you're going to add, whether you sit in formal meditation, whether you're volunteering out there with a good intention, whether you set your intention every morning, you have some kind of premise, some kind of basis as you're waking up to set off rather than just having your list motor over you and you jump out of bed and suddenly you're all overwhelmed. Okay? So you have to get real on that level. Okay, and here's another thing that we get bowled over by. From Darwinists, for instance, this theory in our culture, a little bit of fittest, the fittest is the best. And fittest could translate into many things, the most successful or the richest or the one with the biggest house or this kind of car or that their kids all went to those schools or, you know, everything goes well for them like that. So we, again, prop ourselves up, and when it's not going that way, and we are, I would say, very brainwashed by Hollywood movies, the ones that have these happy endings, that we, you know, many years we saw films like that. You know, that's not really life. It never really tells us how it really is, okay? So you don't want to get so brainwashed by that type of stuff. And then what happens is, as a result of that, we suffer from self-fulfilling prophecies of selfishness. So I need to make sure I become successful in that way to do these things, and I need to take care of myself. You know, it all has to be about myself. Okay? So I am going to talk a little later about self-compassion. That's important. That's different than self-serving things and selfishness, self-compassion. Okay? Let's look at empathy for a moment. Empathy, our natural ability, and then we are going to take a break at in a little bit. Is everybody okay? Okay. Empathy is our natural ability to understand other people's feelings and share in their experience. Our natural ability to understand other people's feelings and share in their experience. Taking compassion a little further. Compassion, again, is the wish that others be free of suffering. The wish that others be free of suffering. Different from love. What is love? Because we're coming up on Valentine's Day. What is real love?
The wish that they're happy.
The wish that they're happy. That's how it differs from compassion. Love is wanting others to be happy. Compassion is wanting to free them from their suffering. And so it's something you can explore this Valentine's Day, is the how much do you conditionally love the people closest to you? Or unconditionally love the people closest to you? Do you have if, ands, and buts on your love? I love you when, I love you if, I love you but, you know, those kind of hold back, or is it really about the other person's happiness? Is that what you're motivated by? Now, it doesn't mean you don't teach your young kids well, that they can't just have ice cream every day, every meal. That's not wisdom. So you have to have the love, wanting them to be happy, connected with your wisdom. Same with compassion. You want to have this wish that others are free of suffering, promoted on the foundation of my wisdom, whatever wisdom you have. Okay? I'm not talking about just intelligence. It's like an innate, and we're trying to grow this wisdom, this innate understanding of how things really are. You want to bring as much of that into it as possible. Then it's true love and true compassion. So, empathy consists of two key components: an emotional response to someone's feelings and a cognitive understanding of his or her situation. So our emotional response may take the form of resonance, in which we experience an emotion similar to the other person's. You know, because my mother died, if you tell me your mother died, I know what that's like now. I know. I don't know specifically where your mind's going with how it feels, but I know what it's like to have your mother die. Capital K, no. Okay? It's a kind of feeling with. A feeling with. Okay? Or it could be a feeling for the other. A sense of sorrow for a person's misfortune without actually feeling what the person's feeling. So we have both of those operating. And sometimes they say literally empathy, to be able to feel with, where compassion is more to suffer with. But this is to be able to feel with, the sensitivity to others' feelings. And empathy is really, in a sense, at the heart of the golden rule, you know, do unto others as you would have them, you know. So in a sense, because it connects me with all these beings, of course I'd want to do to them what I'd want done to me. That's how we feel together with, like that. Okay. Let me go through a little thing of some, let me see, different philosophers on empathy. From Rousseau, how do we let ourselves be moved by pity if not by transporting ourselves outside of ourselves and identifying with the sufferer? By leaving, as it were, our own being to take on its being. Now, he uses the word pity, but I'm replacing empathy, because pity is not necessarily a positive word in Buddhism, because it a little bit makes the other person a victim. Empathy, I'm trying to understand your situation and having a resonance with it and feeling with you. Different. But you can see some of these different philosophers just talking about by transporting ourselves outside of ourselves and identifying with the sufferer. So this is all staying quite open. They even talk about, this is from Jimpa's book, Adam Smith, the founders of market economy. The source of our fellow feeling, he has a hyphenated word, fellow feeling for the misery of others. Yeah. Because this is a shared thing. So what I'm trying to do is help you connect more to others rather than turning away. And the empathy is the thing that, like, I'm actually feeling with you. I'm not kind of shrinking back. Pity is, oh, I'm so sorry for you, but I'm here above it. I'm not experiencing that. Empathy is like, I'm going to get down there in the trenches with you. Now, I may not have had the exact experience, but wow, does that suck. You know, I'm going to be here with you. Sometimes you have a friend that lost their partner. Long-term partner died, you know, and or you have a friend that was diagnosed with cancer. So this is going on more and more and more. For some odd reason, I just found out, my father's street, it's a suburban neighborhood of Philadelphia. There's three women I know on the street that are breast cancer survivors. They're doing well, okay? One of them just finished treatment, one finished 2 years ago, and one many years ago. So we were all at a gathering the other week together. Somebody had a party at their house because one neighbor's leaving. So I went over to see the neighbors, and they're lovely people, the neighborhood, wonderful people. So I was there, and I was talking to a couple of the women that are survivors and just saying, you know, it's kind of a cluster. There's three of you on the street. And she said, oh, no, there's 14 of us on the street. 14 women. So I was like, have you contacted anybody? Like the CDC? Like the what? I mean, it's a cluster. That's a big cluster in, you know, a couple of blocks of houses. It's really kind of, that was a bit startling. Even though I do know women that have lived there for years that do not have it. But that was kind of scary. Okay? So this fellow feeling. So if somebody loses a life partner, gets cancer, again, to be feeling with them is what happens with people with cancer, I've noticed, and people that lose a partner and you're in this grief mode and cancer, there's shock, and if you're going through treatment, you're wasted often. Okay? So what happens is people say, oh, let me know if there's anything I can do. They're not going to let you know. People aren't reaching out in that great sense of grief and fear and, right? So you just have to keep showing up and pushing it. I just bring the food to the house. I don't even care if you want it or if you don't eat it, don't worry about it. But here's soup for your family. Here's a big thing of soup. If it helps you guys, if you want it, great. If you don't want to eat it, just throw it out. Doesn't matter, you know. Just throw, and you know what, I'm going to call you every day. I said to one of the women, I'm going to call you every day. If you can't talk, just let it roll into the voicemail. You see that it's me, you don't want to talk, you don't want to answer the phone, you're not going to bother me in the least. At least tell people they don't need to take care of me. Because a lot of times people are grieving, people have cancer, and then they feel like they have to take care, women do this particularly, they have to take care of how everybody's responding to their cancer. Well, they're the ones with cancer, for God's sake. Why do they need to take care of you? Because you're uncomfortable with their cancer. And I've seen this, especially the woman who gets it, her father who's very old, has fear and is very uncomfortable, so she's trying to manage his feelings. So I don't want somebody having to take care of me in that situation. So I'll just say, you're not going to offend me. You'll see my name come up on the thing. You don't want to answer the phone? Don't answer the phone. You want to leave me a message? You don't want to talk to me? Just text me. And I'll deliver whatever you need. I'll go to the store and get what you want. Once a day I'm going to ask you if you need anything at the store. Like that. So, and they respond. They'll be like, yeah, I do. Because they know it's safe and they know I'll just drop it off and I don't need to have a long dissertation with them. I'm not going to give them the pity eyes when they have cancer. You know, some people don't tell people they have cancer or they don't want to see people because it's like, oh, how are you? You know, they just want you to talk normally to them. You know, I'm going to the store anyway. What do you guys need? Eggs? Milk? You know? So it's easier that way. It's just, and again, you don't want to over push yourself. That's why I just said I'll call. You don't want to answer? Don't answer. often, or maybe I'll call every other day. Or what works for you? Does it work if I stop by every afternoon for an hour? You want me to stop by every Friday for an hour? Is that a good, you know, just if I'm going to tell you that I'm going to be here, that I am here for you. So I'm just going to present that to somebody. It can be really helpful for people. So from some of the philosophers, Buddhists express it slightly differently, some similar ideas from a slightly different perspective. We read about in Buddhism our natural capacity for empathy arising from our felt sense of connection. There's that word again, connection, or identification with the other. Early Buddhist texts describe this clear appreciation of the other's sentient nature, that you have a mind with a consciousness. In fact, valuing the other. Okay, so Jimpa mentioned, he's Tibetan. He mentioned when he was raised, I think in India, maybe, I can't remember originally in Tibet, but in India, when he was raised, he said that his family, I mentioned this last night, just the fact that he was an individual, he had value in his family. He didn't have to prove anything to them. So isn't that interesting about some of our culture, where I know a lot of my friends said their parents put a lot of pressure on them to be a certain, go into a certain vocation, go to a certain university, certain this, have certain friends, and get a certain job. And there was all this, there's a lot of pressure. I had that the same thing growing up myself. A lot of pressure. Sometimes kids will say it was the pressure that their parents, what they didn't accomplish, they would live it out through their kids. So the kids had to be that. A lot of pressure. Then you have peer pressure. And you have neighbor and colleague pressure and friend pressure of certain things, because we tend to be a bit competitive, our culture in general. And then it's kind of reinforced. And I noticed, I was in New York teaching for a week. I just left a couple days ago. There was a snowstorm. All of a sudden, there was a snowstorm. It was 63 degrees. One afternoon, I went out with no jacket. And by the next morning, there was a half a foot of snow on the ground. It was bizarre. And then I was trying to get back to Philadelphia in the middle of the snowstorm. It was really fun. So I was just teaching there, and I just noticed how most of you are familiar with the idea of New York, or you've been there, of certain things around the students of the center that kind of, one of them was saying, you just see images in New York, fashion, certain, you know, pictures that are in windows, and they start telling you, like, you need to look like this. But the things they look like are not what most people look like. You know, most people don't look like fashion models. So I find it so odd. Like, why are they the ones modeling clothes? You know? Because that's not what people look like. Tall and stick thin, starving. And that's why in magazines, why are they always looking so miserable? Well, because they're tall and thin and starving. Maybe. Stick figures of... But why can't models in these high-end fashion magazines, why can't they smile? So you're getting this imprint. Not that we're looking at a lot of fashion magazines, I don't, but still, you still see it. It's around occasionally. I picked up the magazine in the airline yesterday, in the airplane. What do you see in the magazine? Right? Or you see things about, you got to have that kind of luggage, you got to buy that, you got to, right? So if I wasn't clear and centered in myself, I'd be like, well, you know, well, my suitcase is cheaper than that. Maybe I'm not doing that well. So Jimpa said he was just valued on just being a human being. Can you just, again, everyone's been your mother. The potential exists that everyone has been your mother. Isn't that glorious enough? And again, I know not everyone has a great relationship with the mother of this life, but think about that mother love in general. And you have potential to have this connection with everybody like that? That's pretty special. There's nothing like that mother love. There's nothing like it. So, you know what? So a little bit, trying to think when we're going to take our break. Oh, yeah, we'll take our break soon. At the break time, I like to do exercises. Instead of blah, blah about just nothing, okay? Please direct your speech. It would be great if you could meet a new person. Introduce yourself to somebody new. Be nice. To somebody new. Go up and introduce yourself, and can you speak about Just try to see people, first of all, in that more glorious light of just valuing who they are rather than judging. Watch if a judgment goes out. Like, you see somebody and then you're kind of like, oh, his pants are ripped. And I wonder if he's, does he not pay attention to that? Is it, you know, just watch the judgment. You don't have to get engaged with it. I watch sometimes sweeping judgments come out. I watch how the sweeping judgment just top, I just knock the person down. I just mowed over them. I'm not even seeing them. So then I kind of go, okay, wait a minute. Sometimes I get my little reins out on the judgment. Whoa, get back here. Okay, but amusingly, I'm not laying a trip on myself of like, oh, you're so stupid, you have judgments. Again, I'm a human being and I accept my fundamental situation. I'm limited. So I watch a judgment. Whoa, who's the person? Oh, there's a person there. Person there. I could have a potential friend, new friend out there, if I'm open, if this is staying open to that, or am I kind of like, me, myself, and I? So a little bit discuss the feeling of when do you notice that the mind is judging, and when am I just taking people for their face value? What's the experience of my mind? Can you notice the experience of your own mind and discuss that? You can also discuss, what is it when, what are your coping mechanisms when you're faced with pain? You see pain in front of you in someone else? Your own pain? What are your coping mechanisms? What do you do in that situation? So that would be a little helpful. We're going to take a 15-minute break. Everybody clear? So no blah, blah, blah about the movie, okay? Try to have a little bit more directed with the speech. Okay, are there any questions before we take a break? Yes. Because if you just came in, we're going to take a break. If you just came in, we're breaking for lunch at 12:30. So we're going to take a break in the session first. Yes.
Hey, I don't know how articulate I can be about it. Even talking about pain, I get emotional. I apologize.
Okay.
But I just have to go with it. But
wait, can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
Okay. We mentioned this last night. Were you here last night? Okay. We mentioned this last night. So did you ever notice somebody loses a life partner? I met somebody here last night that I know for a long time who lost her life partner. So she started crying. Okay. It's normal. Right? Some people meet with me and they start crying. They're bringing up some deep emotional things. That is not a problem at all. And they immediately are like, I'm sorry. You don't have to apologize. So this is a habitual tendency. We all do it. And we learn from other people. So I grew up in my household, crying doesn't help. One of my parents made fun of us when we cried. Why? Because my dad, he couldn't get in touch with that himself. He just couldn't. It was the way he was raised, and a lot of guys in our society, I feel for you, you cannot cry in public. Well, with me, it's okay. You can cry. Okay? His Holiness the Dalai Lama cries in public. Our last president cried in public. Right? I love that about him. But, you know, we have stuff. It's okay. It's okay, but we say I'm sorry because it makes somebody else uncomfortable. It's okay. So it's a little bit, for me, reframing that I don't have to say I'm sorry. I'm just crying. Is that? Please, sorry. Go for it.
Now you said sorry. You talked about sitting with pain, and I feel like some of us in here might be over-empathizers, so we get overstimulated, and the good is wonderful, but we also get huge doses of all the troubles in the world. And you talked about very specific personal things where you were able to help, but some of us, just a lot of information that you don't even know how you can help, and you just get overwhelmed with it. And sitting with it can just take you to a place where you stay in pain, and mm-hmm. It feels overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered if you had advice on how to work through that.
Yeah, yeah. Because there are people that are more sensitized, and in some ways it's a beautiful trait to have, I would say. But then you want to balance things, because I always ask myself, I used to be very oversensitized, and I'm still quite sensitive to people's energy, and I would get toppled by it. So what I've learned is I'm not that helpful to others when I'm in that space and I get knocked over. or I'm just such a mess and so overwhelmed with it that I can't do anything. So I've learned a little bit of, like, I'm holding the energy, I'm with you, but I'm also trying to estimate, is there something I can do that's helpful? I'm weighing in my mind at the moment, I'm reflecting, and because the mind can do two things at the same time. And then I might evaluate, you know what, the best thing for me to do right now is just be here with the person and listen to them. I'm just going to sit calmly. I might breathe, take deep breaths sometimes, and as you exhale, let some of the negativity go. Let some of the fear go. Let the overwhelm go. You know, let the over go, so you're just whelmed, right? And so, you know, but play with it, meaning honestly, play with it a little bit, where I'm inhaling hope, exhaling pessimism. Inhaling peace of mind, exhaling agitation. Inhaling doing the best I can do, exhaling freaking out. Like, so a little bit, I've done exercises where if I'm in with people and I'm feeling this overwhelm, if you find a space where you can take yourself away for a moment, it can just be 3 minutes. So again, skillful means do whatever is practical sometimes, and also tell yourself that you're doing the best you can. But the breath, this is basic mindfulness practice. Use your breath to support you. It's happening anyway. But when you get overwhelmed, you're shallow breathing. So the oxygen's not circulating well enough, so then I might just need a few more breaths. I can be in somebody's face and just be like, you know, somebody's giving me a lot of tragedy that's going on, and I'm just making sure I'm breathing deeply to hold it, to give myself a container.
So then there would be no need to really focus on their pain, because obviously you can already feel the pain. So you would just be trying to be like the clear pot of gold almost that's giving off some sort of radiance.
I wouldn't even put that pressure on yourself yet. It would be more, I'm just being who I am, just going to be here with you. Because if I start to have to put myself up into this thing that I need to be the radiance, I become a fixer again. Sometimes, the other thing is, sometimes you can't fix it. You know, samsara is a broken situation. So the more without having a direct perception of emptiness, the nature of reality, it means that I take rebirth in samsara. Samsara is a Sanskrit word to turn. Birth, old age, sickness, and death is what we're turning through. And all of it is suffering. All of it is unfortunate. It has positive aspects, but all of it's suffering. So the more I understand its nature, the more I can appreciate the good things, and the more I can participate to help. But it's when we don't, when we deny samsara, and I think everything's going to be perfect one day, and people aren't going to suffer, and everything's going to be okay. And here's the other thing. This is maybe from Pema Chodron, her book, Living Beautifully with Uncertainty and Change, which I love. I would give up, if you're ready for this, I don't know if everybody's, I would give up the idea that you're ever going to totally have it together. Let that go. I found it so liberating. You know, so you don't need to be the light and be, when you're feeling really balanced and completely centered and really doing the practice, you're automatically going to be that for the person. But sorry, I kind of interrupted you. Are you like that? So you're just going to show up with as much as you can. And if it gets too overwhelming, are there ways to limit the stuff that's coming in that's making you feel overwhelmed at times?
Yeah, but sometimes you can feel like you're hiding. But I think that for now, like personally, I'm limiting it so that I can get a bit stronger in dealing with it.
Yeah, that's wise. That's your wisdom. That's your wisdom. Like that. So that's what you have to do. People that are oversensitized, slowly you engage to a level. You know, some people are just, they can deal with anything because they're totally numb. You know, that's not useful either. Just totally denial, nothing, no reaction, no, it's like, did you hear what I just said? So-and-so just died, you know, and there's, oh, that's too bad. You know, there's no contact. So again, everybody has their own space that they're working. It's very individual. So it sounds like you're doing well, as I would just take limit when you can, then you put your toe in the water again. And speaking of samsara, this is a little bit to give you another understanding. We keep thinking everything's going to work out okay in samsara. It never does. That's why just let it go that you're going to have it all together. It doesn't mean you don't participate with wisdom in your reality. You got to get your kids to school. You got to get dressed in the morning. You got to do the laundry. You got to work. Those things, you know, you want to participate, but we have lists. Don't you have endless lists? Right? So because, and then when there's always going to be more on the list. So it's like, how are you being with your lists? What's your attitude when you go out there every day? That's more important than getting the stuff done, I think. When you die, that's what's going to be, how open was my heart? How was I when I encountered various people? That's going to be more important, I think, for your dying mind, the peace of your mind, rather than, it was great, I got everything done, you know. And still you die. You get everything done and you still die. So samsara is, one of the lamas said, I think Geshe Jumpa Tekchog passed away some years ago, so he said, if you're in a swimming pool filled with water, we know the nature of water is it's moist. If you're in a swimming pool filled with water, you don't flail around and go, it's wet in here. You know that's the nature. But with samsara, we're constantly, the car doesn't start one day, and you get all pissed off. That's its nature. Cars break down. You get sick, you get the flu. You're going to be railing against people. It's sometimes you get sick. People die. So it's, again, how open can I keep my heart mind in the face of that, because I'm understanding samsara, so I know there's going to be misfortune. I know that's going to show up. How am I going to be with it when it shows up? Can I be brighter? Can I be wiser? Calmer? Can I bring the ground under other people? I'm not going to layer that on me yet until I feel that I'm well enough to automatically do that. Then you become that space for people. Naturally, though, automatically. Is that helpful?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Any other questions? Okay, so 15 minutes. Thank you very much. Can I charge the computer? Is there a plug that I can, or I can plug it in over there? Yeah, let me do that. So again, a little bit more in empathy is just that we are obviously acknowledging someone else's feelings, as we might say honoring the person, this sense of regard for others. How it works in the brain, how empathy works in the brain, the limbic system, for one, okay, known for its role in processing emotional signals. It works in there. A second way, empathy activates neural networks. This is a lot in Jinpa's book, that are part of the attachment system. So, for instance, attachment means attachment system in this regard is the way a mother attaches to its baby. So it has a crucial role in that. And there's obviously studies they've done with kids that didn't have that relationship with their mother. Homeless kids, abandoned babies, and they don't have that kind of nurturing thing. Finally, when it arises in response to someone else's suffering, and there's in a sense what scientists call pain matrix. So brain regions associated with our personal experience of pain. And so they can be accentuated in people or not developed at all. Where some people, you know, some people that aren't really empathetic. That, you know, something happens for somebody and they're like, oh well, you know. So obviously different things have been obstructed a little bit. Now did you guys, I'm picking on you guys right now, did you meet anybody new? I see the two of them talking and, you know. No, I'm joking. I'm just picking on you guys. Okay. So there's been scientific studies, sociological studies, that and what most of them point to is our capacity for empathy, understanding, compassion, kindness, altruistic behavior is actually inborn, innate with us. Okay? It's not that it's something that we learn and grow. It's actually part of who we are, part of the makeup. So naturally, this tendency to have the heart wide open is actually part of who we really are. Meaning when you uncover, when you remove the obscurations to your Buddha nature, as we would call it in the Tibetan system, this potential again, Buddha nature is simply a seed that can develop into you being a highly realized being. This seed, this potential, okay, and everyone with a mind has it. So you say, I'm not a Buddha yet. It doesn't mean you're a Buddha. It means you have this potential to develop into that, like that. So that's actually who you really are. So when you're around someone like His Holiness the Dalai Lama or Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you get a little sense of that, a taste of it, and you like it. You like to be around it because there's nothing obstructing their compassion because it's actually part of their full manifestation of their being. So we can, again, reconnect with that. What happens is cultural experiences, cultural influences, influences environmental from our family, how we're raised, peer pressure, create that we start to make walls in this experience. We make boxes. Every time we judge, and I've even noticed when I'm traveling, whether it's overseas or here, and people say to me, where are you from? So if it's in the States and I say Philadelphia, well, now they have this context and they go, oh, okay. Yeah. You know, now they got me. Right? Because I say I was, you know, I've only lived, been based back there for 2 years, even though I'm from there. But what does that mean? And I've seen people overseas, oh, you're American. Okay, so I see how the Europeans view that. Oh, American, yeah. They don't really like us to some degree. Indians, they're elated to meet an American. For them, it's a land of opportunity. And they're very friendly culture. Oh, but you see how so immediately when somebody says, I live over here, I work for so-and-so, you walk out to somebody's car, you see the kind of car they drive, you create a little box. I've got a compartment now, I'm going to put them in it. And then I feel safer because I got everybody in their little areas, and all it does is obstruct this, like that. So it's just something you can check on, because innately, we don't have any boxes. In the actual full experience, full manifestation of who we are, fully expanded heart. So you can all reach that level. Just takes time. Obviously, we're pretty clear about the benefits of compassion. Okay? Empathy is feeling for or with other people and understanding their feelings. When we witness another person suffering, in particular, compassion arises from empathy. Okay, adding the dimensions of wishing to see relief of their suffering, wanting to do something about it. All those things get accessed, obviously. So compassion is a more empowered state more than an empathetic response to a situation. Compassion's where you take it out there then. Empathy's first, I have to first experience the feeling. And in that experiencing the feeling, I'm evaluating. Hopefully you have enough control of your mind or you will develop it to evaluate, what can I do in this situation? Should I just remain and be with the person and listen to them? And should I just realize that I'm not going to fix this, that it's just more important for me to be with them openly, non-judgmentally, make sure that I'm actively listening? Or actually, no, you know, there is some stuff I can do for them. So compassion then is when you step out and you go, okay, here we go. I'm going to take action. Kindness is then the expression of the compassion through helping, a basic form of altruism. And compassion is what makes it possible for empathetic reaction to manifest in kindness. Okay? And again, you have to practice to have these well-oiled. Okay? It's not that we often have a quickly compassionate response if we're not normally thinking that way. I do know some very self-centered people. I'm sure we all do. Right? And so they're not exercising that. So immediately something comes up, and I've heard them sometimes. A response happens, there's a little bit of a little drama going on in the family over here, and then you see them, and their response is, you wouldn't believe this, what about me? Many times I've seen this with a couple people that I know. What about me? It's like, we're not even talking about you. We got, hello? But this is some people, this is what they've well exercised. This is what they rehearse. It's always the what about me story, right? Really tiring. You get tired. And the thing is, they never are satisfied. The what about me never, that tape never ends. What about me, okay? Because we do have this, as human beings, the false sense of our I jumps out. So as long as you want to court that, it's going to continually nag at you and be unfulfilled, unsatiated. But again, please check. Please check that. And a lot of our culture is going in that direction, and we get swayed by it. You know, well, this person at work, I mean, they made sure they got their promotions, and they went into things, and they went, you know, and then here I am, and I'm not getting anywhere, and I don't like them. And so if you want to ruminate through that, that gets exercised. That trench gets deeper. I know it's hard. I know it's not easy. So unless you work at compassion, unless you practice and change the habits of the selfishness, make it an active force in your life, it's only kind of something that happens to us. You get angry when provoked. You feel compassion when triggered. An automatic reaction to the pain and needs of our loved ones. Sometimes a stranger, it has to be something acute. You see something really dramatic, then you activate the compassion. It's not just a normal way that you are being. When you're around His Holiness, it's just who He is all the time. Can be minor levels with somebody you see, bigger levels. It's just always there. And you feel it. You feel this breath of it. It's intoxicating on that level in a good way, in a good way. So I just want you to close your eyes for a moment. We're going to do our Chenrezig practice this afternoon, but I want you to close your eyes for a moment. Just a short reflection. Allow your mind to settle on the breath for a moment. Check your posture again. What are the habits you get into with your posture? Can you think of someone now in your life who has been a figure of kindness for you? Just thinking about them right now fills you with joy and gratitude.
could be a teacher who helped you at school, a parent, a mentor, that helped you recognize your personal strengths at an early age or at any time in your life. Could be a loyal friend who lets you know they have your back. And just weave through some of the interactions you've had with this person, noting what the kindness that you received from them, how it impacted you. Just relax. You can open your eyes. So we have this wish to be kind to others, and sometimes we're forcing it or we're not in touch with it, and I find it helpful to reflect back on people that have been kind to me and how it's made me feel. It's a nice place to go to, isn't it? I don't know how many of you, and if you didn't have anybody that popped up, take some time and think about it later. Think about it tomorrow or another day where somebody pops up, or you might just see something. Something may come to you. Sometimes we're not so much into receiving kindness from others. We push it away. So I've negated all that. No, it's not happening. It's not happening. Get away from me. Okay? So that's something, as well, in our discomfort and pain, I just look at. Just observe it. Gently observe. You don't have to say that, oh, I didn't want that. See what I've done. I've ruined myself. No, it's like, For a long time I was like that when I lived in the city. I was a city girl. I liked the anonymity of cities. And then when I moved to Vajrapani, I couldn't live there and function without asking other people for help and receiving their kindness. And it was very hard for me in the beginning. Because, you know, I'm just my own bubble myself. I can do it myself. I don't need anybody, you know. But again, from last night, our independence is dependent on our interdependence, by the way. We want to be independent. These are Americans. The most independent people I've met on the planet are people living in the United States. I know we're not all Americans here, right? But for white people, this country was founded, as I said yesterday, on independence. People came here for freedom. Again, for white people, came here for freedom. Religious freedom, other kinds of freedom. So what happens is often if you evaluate a foundation of a certain country and a culture, right, it's still rooted in the descendants. And Americans I meet are the most fiercely independent cultures I've ever met, for the most part. Intensely independent. But again, your independence is based on a foundation of interdependence. It's different than independence. We are connected to each other. We cannot function without that interrelation. How would there be a center here if it wasn't for other people? Right? There's no way. How would your cars function without this interdependence of all the connections that got the material, made the vehicle, the fuel, the electricity, all the components, your house, the food you eat? There's no way we can live on the planet. So it's more helpful to get in touch with the interdependence. And I love the idea of somebody giving kindness, showing kindness to me, melts me when I'm really got a handle on it. When I don't think I can give anymore, or I don't want to, or I'm thinking about me, myself, and I think of the kindness somebody showed me. When I first came to a Dharma center, I didn't know anything. So I'd ask one thing about, what's that picture of? But you're in a hurry, you don't have the time. But the 1-3 minutes you could take to just say, oh, this is about this, this is how, that could just be the thing that opens up the door for them 10 years later to tell somebody else. Many times. Many ways of kindness, basic kindness. We talked a little bit about driving last night. Did you drive kindly this morning? Some of you not drive that kindly? There's something about our vehicles. When there's certain people I know, when they get behind the wheel of the car, it's Jekyll and Hyde. What happens? A dear nun friend of mine, I love her. She's one of the kindest people I know. She's always doing for others till she gets behind the wheel of the car. I met her in India. The first time I drove with her in the States, she was driving. I was like, who are you? What's happened to you, you know? Where's my friend? Can you access my friend? Can she come out right now and play? Because I don't know who you are. So you have to think about it. What's the deal like that? And notice, how are you in the markets? How do you go to the supermarket? Okay? I mentioned before, bodhisattva principle, bodhisattva attitude. Some of you were here before I mentioned. How do you go to the supermarket? Because bodhisattva is a Buddhist saint. What they're trying to do is practice the totally open heart. Lama Yeshe used to call, when you have actualized bodhicitta, which again is a Sanskrit term, bodhi is enlightenment, citta is mind. When you've actualized the mind of enlightenment, it's about wanting to get enlightened to benefit all living beings. That's the mind of bodhicitta. And when you actualize that, you become a bodhisattva. Okay? So Lama used to call it totality heart. You're using your whole heart. We're often kind of, I've got this little piece for you, because I need the rest of it for me. Take care of myself. Totality heart. Imagine the fully open, awakened experience. And then we have our internal practice, my meditation, reflection, something went wrong today. What happened? I've got to go back to my cushion and evaluate. I wasn't happy today. Well, what happened? Why not? You have to investigate. You have to do that. Then my external practice. I take it out there in the world. Driving, interacting with people at the center. We're going to have lunch soon. How are you going to go do your lunch? How are you with the wait people or wherever you are getting your lunch? So how does a bodhisattva go to the supermarket? You have many supermarkets here, I take it. Right? So bodhisattvas have their list. You're allowed to have a list. Going to the supermarket. When you mentioned, thank you, my dear, highly sensitive, sensitized, right? Bodhisattvas are very highly sensitized to the needs of others around them. Okay, but they have a high level of realization. So that's what we're trying to develop. So then when I do take in the sensitivity from everyone else, I can handle it. In fact, it's my job. You're never unemployed again. It's my reason for being, and it's the source of my happiness. It's like that. It's literally the source of your happiness. So we practice. So you go into the supermarket as a bodhisattva. We can all practice this. Practice this, okay? You have your list. And they're highly sensitized to the beings around them because that's who they are. It's all about others. It's all about cherishing others more than yourself. Here they come in the supermarket. So what do? They get their cart and they go and they get all their stuff, but they're constantly looking around. I know I've mentioned this before in these classes here. Some people need help in the supermarket, right? Sometimes somebody needs help. Somebody, you know, I've seen people, I go to this one store to get my dad his cheese or something, and you have to take a number at the deli counter because there's so many people getting it. And I see people that come up and they don't know about the number, or they don't know where the numbers are, or they'll say, what number are they on? And you get, hey, oh, did you take a number? You see somebody walk up later, you have to get a number. They're right over there. Oh, here. You want a number? Easy way to help somebody. I told you once I met a guy. Sometimes you see this. It was dinner time. I happened to dash into the supermarket. It was dinner time. Here comes a guy down the aisle. You can feel it. I could feel him coming down the aisle. Totally stressed out. Okay, I'm looking at, I forget what I was looking at. Something. Pickles or something. Buy something, and he comes down the aisle, but I can feel his energy all the way at the end of the aisle. Complete stress. He's got like a 3-year-old kid in his cart. And the kid's like trying to pull everything off, you know, and he's like rushing down the aisle, and I see him looking, panic. So I just look, like, what's going on? I don't normally see people like that in the supermarket, but sometimes. And I looked, and now he's got his back to me. He's looking at the other aisle. Scanning, but frantic. I could just feel this frantic energy. So I kind of just turned, just thinking, what's going on? Is everything okay? You know, I turn and he turns to me because I gave him an opening. Can you tell me where I can find pickled beets? Literally, it was just, you know, so obviously my impression was the wife is home with the kids screaming all day and he comes home from work or whatever. She's like, get out of here. You take the kid and just get out of here. And don't come home until you bring me pickled beets. We need them for dinner tonight. I don't want to see you until he's in the supermarket. He doesn't know the supermarket that well. Just my impression. I don't really know what was going on for him, but it was just my story. But he needs pickled beets desperately, or he's going to die. I mean, it looked like that. And then I was like, you know, it's not something I buy often, pickled beets. So I was like, where would they be? And he was kind of close. He was in the pickles. And then I went, oh, canned vegetables. And then we found them in that aisle. And he nearly kissed me. He's like, thank you. You know, so there's people that you can help. There's people that are confused. They're looking for something. Many times. Okay, you've gotten your cart full. You're done. Got your list. Now what do you do? Bodhisattva warrior in the supermarket. What do you do? You check out, right? What do you do when you check out? You get in line? You get in the longest line. You get in the longest line. Okay. Now you're allowed, bodhisattva warrior, you're practical. You're allowed to get, people look for the shortest line. Right? Of course, you look for the shortest line. Okay. So you look for the shortest line. Bodhisattva warriors are overly sensitized to others. So they got in their line now, but they're not quite ready to unload. Somebody's in front of them. Okay. So one of the things you do in the line, bodhisattva warrior, sorry, you're not allowed to read the tabloids. They don't do that. It's garbage in your mind. Garbage imprinting in your mind. You don't need it. The other thing they do is they turn the other direction, and there's all the delectable treats, all the candy bars, breath mints, right? Why are they there? They're designed because you're like, oh, yeah, I just peanut M&Ms, sure. You know, I could use those right now. Again, so they resist the mind of desire because they're focused on looking around the store for the guy that shows up with the one jar of mayonnaise, and they're going to let them in front. You know, because you've got a big order. You've got a lot of stuff. Sometimes you can't do it because you're in a hurry. That's okay. But generally, somebody's going to come along with a screaming baby in their cart, and you can just put them in front of you. That's what Bodhisattva warriors do. Then they go through, then they make eye contact with the cashier. How are you today? These people have, you know, often somewhat boring job, on their feet a lot. How's it going? Hi. Like that. And Bodhisattva warriors, okay, sorry, this is a little alarming. These are my own ecological views that I feel really strongly about. Bodhisattva warriors bring their bags to the grocery store because they also care about our planet. Please bring bags to the grocery store. We don't need to keep wasting plastic and trees. It's simple. You know, in some countries, they charge you for bags or they don't give out bags. You have to bring your own bag. It's very practical. It's very easy. I keep them in the trunk of my car. I walk in the store. Initially, you're going to forget. Go back to the car and get them out. Make a little effort. You will increase your steps, those of you that track on your phone your steps. Okay? A little bit of walk to the... It's easy. Our lives are easy. It's not a big deal. You go, I left my bags at home. I make a thing. As soon as I unpack the bag, it goes out by the door where I'm going to walk out and pick them up and put them back in the car. Now it's a habit. I feel naked to go in the store without my bags. Right? If you're... Don't go shopping in San Francisco without a bag. People sneer at you. Really. They're like, oh. You know? The cashier's, you don't have your bag? Oh. And everybody in the line's like, oh, God. Right? So it's practice. They exercise that. That it's part of their culture now. You can't show up without a bag. It's like people don't like that. It's responsible for the planet. Something to think about. Sorry to voice my views about that, but I feel really strongly about that. I have a few things like that. I'm just like, it's so simple, right? You can get cool bags, too. Buy cool bags, okay? So this is, these are ways, like this is just practical life that you can practice. It doesn't take any great realization. You just want to go in a little bit heightened level of awareness. Many people you can help. Holding the door for somebody. You're walking into a restaurant. You're now, it doesn't mean that there you are in line for lunch right now. Right now, and we have a break, there's a certain amount of time, and you're going to be holding the door for everybody. Come on. Be practical again. Be practical. Okay? You will honestly get a helper's high from this because it goes both ways with practicing compassion. You do something kind for someone. Check yourself. You get a lot out of it. It's actually one of the components that can kick you out of depression is to volunteer and do something kind for someone else. It doesn't need to even be a formal volunteer program. You know, I had in my early 20s, I was working too much and suffered from depression. I just felt really like I went through a few months and was like, and I didn't really, was aware that I was depressed. And then I went to the doctor because I had all these different ailments that kind of came from it. And then she's like, you're just depressed. And I was like, no, I'm not. No, I'm, you know. And then I realized, and so I did these little exercises, and there was a woman, old woman that lived upstairs, and she came home once with her. I remember I was really sitting in the mine, really down one day, and I happened to come home when she did, and she had packages. So I just automatically, you know, took them up to her apartment. I mean, I couldn't have her. What was she going to do? It was just, you know, anybody would help. So I took them up to her apartment. And then I just noticed that she was so happy. So she was so happy, it kind of gushed onto me, into my little, like, I didn't want to be happy. I'm like, no. You know, and then she kind of vomited that. The waterfall came over to me, and I was like, and then she invited me in, and we had cookies, and suddenly, connection. It's hard to stay depressed when I suddenly had this kindness from somebody else, and the two of us were connected. And then we had this relationship, and then we were constantly doing good things for each other. And I'd find she'd leave a bag of cookies at my door, and she'd do stuff. And then I got sick, and she left cough medicine. She could hear me coughing. You know, it's stuff like that. So that's how the world goes around more harmoniously. You can choose divisiveness. You can choose kindness. You can choose kindness. And again, what happens in our independent realm, you go around with blinders on. I got to my store, I got my order, I got my parking space, back in my car. It doesn't mean you still can't progress through your day practically, but I take the blinders off, I have opportunities I can help, and then it's going to bounce back and make me feel better. So initially, His Holiness will say, then be selfish like that, because you want to feel good, you want that feel-good feeling. Be selfish like that then. So I'm going to do practice these kind acts because I want to feel good. Then be selfish like that. And this is interesting about some of these different studies that Jinpa mentions. Studies in which participants were asked to consciously extend compassion to another person, the reward centers of the compassionate brain were activated. They're noticing now there are parts of the brain that get activated when you do compassion meditation versus when you're angry. And you can create new neural pathways now of more positive things in your brain to get activated by doing various exercises and meditations like that. That's how it works. So maybe another good reason to do meditations like that. Okay? So it says that when that compassionate brain, those parts were activated, it's the same brain system that lights up when you think about chocolate. So we like that. You know, people chuckle and we like our chocolate. So I can get that same kind of response of eating chocolate I can from helping somebody and exercising those parts of my brain. So again, it would come back to this kind of selfish focus is the more we're in it for other people, the more we get out of it ourselves. The more we're in it for other people, the more we get out of it for ourselves. So some of the benefits is it makes you happier, obviously. Okay? Gives your life purpose. We talked about that early on. Do you have meaning in life? Compassion very much can direct your life to give it purpose. You can experience less stress. Absolutely. His Holiness also talks about that. So this is what's incredible sometimes, because compassion is the wish to free others from suffering. So since compassion depends on acknowledging unpleasant facts of our own and others' vulnerability and suffering, because part of it's related to that. However, the trick is with happiness seems to be the release from the stress of judging and worrying about ourselves. So as soon as you see somebody distressed, somebody's got tremendous suffering, or big suffering, small suffering, is the trick about it that we don't notice is normally we're consumed with ourselves, judging myself, worrying about myself. I need to do this. And as soon as you see somebody else's thing, I forget about that. It just automatically turns off, and I'm here with you. All of a sudden, wow. I have this interesting experience. I have done a lot of retreats at Laudo, this remote retreat place near Mount Everest I mentioned. So the 2017 pilgrimage I was going to lead this October, I have postponed it to 2018. So if you're interested, there is a link on my website, amymiller.com. If you want a card, I have cards. You can click through, and it will send you to an email to this lovely man here, Chase, who's been so helpful. He's been helping me remotely. And what he does is he just sends you questions, that a little screening process, because I need to make sure it's very remote. I need to make sure you're going to be okay with the primitive conditions and the altitude, like that. And then after we screen and make sure, then there's you know, other things that would go on. So when the last hill, and we're going to do it differently on the pilgrimage, I'm not leading you up that last monstrous hill, but when I go to Laudo by myself and I'm on this last hill that I get to kind of later in the day, I'm struggling tremendously. I'm like, it's, you're already at 12,000 feet. I take 6 steps and I'm, you know, trying to breathe, and it's just agonizing at the top, near the top. I'm just like, you know, am I there yet? You know, it's just really brutal. I'm on the hill for a couple of hours doing that. So when I lead other people up there, which I've done several times, I'm all focused on how they're doing on the hill. It's much easier for me going up that hill. So interesting. So it's just automatic. It's automatic. I'm constantly, I see them struggling. How are you going? Let's take a rest. How are your knees doing? Totally out of my experience. It's like magic, right? With a compassionate shift of focus from our own narrow self agenda, okay, and sometimes the heaviness that tends to go with it, we feel, you automatically feel lighter, okay? The same stressors may be in your life, okay? But because you're not focused on it, they're not stressing you out. Isn't that interesting? So compassion very much has this ability to lighten you up. You feel your individual burden lifted a bit. And basically, you see things in perspective. Very, very helpful in our path to see things in perspective. Often our own little small world is not allowing you. And then the ruminating starts. And now I've got this moat around me of negativity, criticism, self-loathing, whatever. Confusion. Basically just confusion. Okay? Another way compassion helps buffer stress is through understanding, and here's a wonderful word, and tolerance that tends to go with it, tolerance. You know, how tolerant are you? It's a great conversation for lunch. What's your tolerance level? You know, and be honest with yourself. And so it's something you could talk about with somebody else if you want to meet somebody new for lunch, if you want to go out with somebody you already know. But how does tolerance play in your, what things can you not tolerate? You have no tolerance for. For me, and I have to expand that, because for me, when I see people checking out the grocery store with all those pile of plastic bags in their cart, and what happens is the bags are so cheap, and they're not biodegradable, I think they're making new ones. What I did is I called Giant Foods. We have Giant Food is near me. That's our supermarket. It's huge. It's Giant, okay? It's a great supermarket, actually. And I phoned them. There's a customer support line. I phoned them, and I just said, I want to talk to you about your plastic bags. What kind are you making? You can do that. That's my little social activism. I just felt like, because there's new biodegradable bags, and they're taking it under consideration, and they said they are interested in doing bags. They've been interested in that before I called. Great, now they got another call. Like that. That's important. So what happens is before they have the biodegradable bags, I'm intolerant when I see the bags are so cheap, they only put 2 items in each bag. So you come out and you got a heap of bags with a big order. I see people. I see the people moving out, right? And then I'm very intolerant. And then I start judging them. And then I start judging all the stuff about them. Right? So then I have some tolerance for myself. Just, wow, that was big judgment. And then I realized from there some compassion for them. Why? I might label them confused, not caring about the environment, not as tuned in as that. I'm also confused. I also have confusion about a lot of things on this planet. We're not that unlike them. So suddenly I can be like, yep. You know, all the years I wasn't focused on bags. I didn't know anything about it. There's many other things I do that they would disagree with. Okay. So suddenly this is still staying pretty open. Okay, I'm not in my, you know, angry stuff like that. Because again, what is anger closing me out from? My sadness at sometimes the destruction of the environment. So I can just acknowledge, wow, I do get upset if something happens with the environment. What can I do about it? I'm doing what I can. I can call my representatives. I can go to marches with a feeling of love and connection, not anger. I can write letters to people. I can talk with my friends about stuff. I can give money to organizations. I can volunteer for environmental groups if that's important. can do that. And then part of it, I realize there's nothing I can do about this, then I let it go. So again, peaceful in here. I'm doing all I can. I'm bright. I feel lifted. I feel light. And I keep moving on. Make sense? Possible you can do? You already do some of this. You're already probably doing this. But again, it's more how to deflect when, you know, I think this and you think that and it's different and I hate you. Like, really powerful. And you never know somebody's experience. You never know somebody's experience. I mentioned before in here, maybe last year, I used to judge people based on the size of their car, size of their vehicle. Because, again, it was an environmental thing. So in the suburbs where I live, do you really need the mile-long SUV? You've got two kids and you don't even have kids. So I was driving along. I have a car that gets 43 miles to the gallon, a little tiny Toyota somebody gave me. Driving along, and here comes one of these gigantor things, one guy in it. I had such a sweeping judgment on him. I knew who he voted for. I had all this kind of just layer upon layer upon layer of, you know, like I knew. Who did I think I was, you know? Clairvoyant. I knew all about him. I had a whole story about him. For some reason, we ended up stopping at the same gas station. And now I'm in line behind him at the store, the convenience store. But, you know, I could feel all my, like, daggers, like, you know. Right? He was a rescue worker, the guy. So the whole back had blankets and water and, what do you call it, first aid stuff, you know, wah, wah. Boy, was I wrong, right? So you don't know. So I really watched the mind kind of, and then gentle with amusement to myself of like, so now it's easier for me when I see the mind go out. I'm like, I don't have a direct perception of emptiness. Until you have a direct perception of emptiness, right, your story is always wrong. I found that so liberating. Because I can watch a story and now I don't have to get invested in it. It's much easier to watch a story just go, boop, dissolve, done. Like that. I don't know. Like that. So tolerance is, with self-honesty, self-acceptance, self-transparency, of self-compassion, which we're going to talk about after lunch, you have nothing to hide, okay? Nothing to hide. There's nothing to be afraid of. Much less to be afraid of. Okay. One class I was just teaching, maybe in New York, and we talked about expressions. If I just say the word self-compassion to you, self-care, what comes up for you? I'm just curious. What words can pop up? Self-compassion or self-care? Yes.
Nurture.
Nurture.
Kindness.
Forgiving.
Sanity.
Great. Thank you. You're all very healthy here. Sometimes it's selfish. So sometimes I heard this. One woman said she's afraid, fear. One said guilty. She feels guilty that it's selfish. So we're going to explore this more. A little bit at lunch you could talk about your experiences of self-compassion and self-care. Are you good at it? Do you feel guilty when you indulge in it, when you practice it? What do you think makes you feel guilty about it? Because, again, we're peeling back layers to get this concepts that she's afraid. There's less to be afraid. And so some people were like, well, what other people think about me? Other people will see me doing this and what they'll think about me. Let that one go. Boy, is that boring, what they think about you. Where I'm focused on what people think about me and what I think is helpful, when we talk in some of the bodhisattva vows and things of shame and consideration, they call it. Not shame in a negative way, like we talked about last night. Shame and consideration, meaning, as a nun, if I stood out by the stupa smoking a cigarette, right, I would be very concerned of what you thought about me because it would disturb your mind. You'd say a nun smoking a cigarette by a Buddhist shrine, like, can I do that if I was ordained? Like, is that okay? Is that, so that's a different kind of shame where you're concerned on that level of having good ethics because of how it impacts other people's minds. That's different. But then when we just go through life with worried about what people think, first of all, people are too busy thinking about themselves to focus on you much. But that's not what the self-important I thinks. It's always about me. And there was somebody dear in my life. I went out with a close friend, spent the day, and somebody I hadn't seen in a while, spent the day, and then we saw somebody else, another close friend later who couldn't join us. And then the friend said, you know, so what'd you guys do today? We said, oh God, we had the best day. We took a long walk in the park and we had our thing, and they said, and then, you know, we just talked about everything. We just caught up on, and the first thing they said, did you talk about me? Like, some people are like that. That's their pointer. It's all about me. Isn't it? Isn't it about me? Okay. So, that creates much less of a concern that I'm worried that they're talking about me is, because if you're doing the right thing, if you're being who you really are, who cares if people are talking about you? And if they are talking about you in that case, they're usually probably saying something positive then. Oh, it's lunchtime. Okay. So some things to talk about: self-compassion, self-care. What comes up for you? What prevents you from practicing it? How do you practice it? You can continue about your coping mechanisms with pain. So a few exercises at lunch if you can try to do that. We come back at 2 o'clock for 2 more hours. We're going to do our Chinrezig practice in the afternoon. And I'd like to just offer our lunches wherever you're eating lunch. Is if you can just focus on all the beings on the planet, number one, who are hungry, starving, and don't have the beautiful food that we have to eat. Could we just imagine offering the food to all of them? And the food relieves their suffering instantly, bringing them to ultimate happiness. Imagine offering the food to all the holy beings, especially embodied in the images around the room. And it brings great bliss to their holy minds. Food which is completely empty in nature. May the food nourish us so we may continue our course in good energy and health. You can continue the rest of your day. And may it help us, whatever information we're getting, to use that to move along the path to full awakening, as then we're completely unlimited in benefiting all other beings. So really, for the purpose of benefiting all others, we will practice the yoga of eating lunch. Om Ahung, Om Ahung, Om Ahung, Lama Sangye Lama Je Dejen Lama Gedun Te Kuni Zepo Lama Te Lama Nam La Je Barbu. Thank you very much. Enjoy your lunch and see you at 2 o'clock.